Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, Lexington arts journalist, writer, and poet Kevin Nance is releasing a book of poetry spanning a lifetime and rooted in his upbringing on a tobacco farm in rural North Carolina. And we'll hear from Max Puchalski, co-founder of Art Farm, a new common space for art making and organizing in Lexington. First, a look at the atmosphere among international communities in Kentucky now that the so-called Big Beautiful Bill has been signed into law, pumping $170 billion into immigration enforcement. This is expected to lead to a dramatic increase in ICE raids, sweeps, and deportations. And later, we'll hear from the Mexican-American manager of a Fayette County horse farm. First, we wanted to know what's happening across Kentucky. Undocumented immigrants are being swept off the streets by masked officers in plain clothes who refuse to give their names. Parents are being handcuffed in front of young children and escorted together onto buses and into detention centers. Officers are tackling people, smashing car windows as they make arrests. We wanted to know how the Trump administration's sweeps, raids, and deportations are playing out in Kentucky. One who is on the front lines of this is State Representative and Immigration Employment Attorney Nima Kulkarni. Representative Kulkarni, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
At the end of March, according to a database on the ICE website, five Kentucky law enforcement agencies had signed agreements with the Department of Homeland Security to support immigration enforcement. Since then, that number has more than tripled to 15. By now, it could be more. Is this increase in ICE participation translating to increased sweeps and detention here in Kentucky that you know of?
That rate of sweeps and detentions is growing. It is not quite as much here because we don't have that many ICE agents or that much of an ICE presence in Kentucky. However, by all accounts, we are looking at a period of time, especially when we're watching very closely this budget bill, which includes a significant amount of money directed specifically towards immigration enforcement. I think that we will see a ramping up of it very shortly, as soon as the funding is made available to states. One of the things that happened last time, so the ramping up of a 287G agreement, which is an agreement between local law enforcement and ICE to assist ICE in federal immigration enforcement actions, was something that was tried in the previous Trump administration, but didn't really go so far because there was not enough funding. And so there is funding tied to training, funding tied to overtime, because these are local law enforcement agencies are stretched thin. So how are they, you know, going to, on top of their current workload and staffing issues and everything that they're facing already, going to add on federal immigration enforcement on which they have no training, no understanding, and make sure that they're not incurring liability themselves for immigration enforcement actions gone wrong, which I'm sure we'll explore in a little bit. But the growth in these agreements is mostly due to promises of funding, promises of either direct funding or equipment and things like that. So we don't know quite what the discussions are between ICE and between these local law enforcement agencies, but that has been evident in, as you mentioned, the tripling of these 287G agreements between law enforcement and ICE.
Well, in addition to serving in the state legislature and your work as an attorney, you're also a founder of the New Americans Initiative, so very plugged into what's going on here. And I wonder how you would describe the atmosphere in Latino and other immigrant communities right now.
Well, it's an atmosphere of fear, of course, and uncertainty, because we have, as practitioners and just as directly impacted communities, been closely monitoring, right, the executive orders, the day one executive orders, the different policies that have been put into place since January of this year. And then, of course, all of the courts and how they're handling the challenges to those orders and those policies. And so it's a little bit of whiplash in terms of one day you're, you know, lawfully present, and tomorrow you may be considered illegal and a priority for deportation. It is very chaotic. And so people just don't know people who have relied on our government giving them the authorization to enter and the authority to work and to live in Kentucky and in the United States. And then all of a sudden that essentially being taken away immediately. So they don't even get a chance to figure out what their immigration options are. It has been this way since January. It's been this way essentially since the election. I'll use Springfield, Ohio as an example, which you'll recall was mentioned in a presidential debate during the campaign, where a lot of Haitian immigrants who had settled there and really revitalized the economy and the population of Springfield, Ohio, had helped that city grow its economy and its businesses. And they left in droves. They were leaving. I mean, as soon as that election happened, because of the promises of mass deportation, the hard line that the administration was taking in terms of immigration enforcement, they left. And so this community has been left reeling just based on that. And that is the case in a lot of different communities, including a lot of Rust Belt cities like Pittsburgh and Buffalo and parts of Cincinnati, right? Which has seen a significant increase in recent years in their Hispanic community, I think specifically Guatemalan, again, who are moving to those places where, you know, it's been largely abandoned. There's not a lot of growth. There's a lot of decay and not a lot of stable economy. And they are coming there. They're moving. They're building businesses. They are working to make a community out of those areas. And they're also seeing this fear. And so people aren't going to work. Kids aren't going to school. Business owners are having to close their doors because they don't know whether or not tomorrow they'll be allowed to continue to build their business or even be in the United States. And so there is definitely a sense of fear, a lot of uncertainty, and a lot of chaos in not just Latino and Hispanic communities, but every single immigrant community, because as we've seen, the rhetoric started out, we're only going after criminals and gang members, violent offenders, right, who have offended in terms of really significant criminal, violated criminal statutes. And I think what we need to understand and what people are increasingly understanding is that nobody is safe. We don't have a lot of people in detention who have committed crimes. And that's something people don't realize. According to recent studies, as of about like mid-June, we're looking at the percentage of individuals who have been detained by ICE, 65% of them have zero convictions, no violent convictions, no nonviolent convictions. And 93% of them have no violent convictions, which means they might have been convicted of a low-level drug offense or potentially a gambling offense or traffic violations. So this is also a significant percentage of individuals who have been detained. These are not the criminals and gang members that the administration promised they were going after. These actions are not keeping our communities safe. They are not, you know, increasing public safety in any way. But what they are doing is increasing the scope and the net of the people that they are saying they're allowed to apprehend and detain. And of course, we've seen third country, right, deportations. So people are being deported without any due process, without a day in immigration court. So there's a lot of fear, not just in the Hispanic community, but now all immigrant communities are understanding that they are all at risk, at the same level of risk, whether or not they are here lawfully. They might be lawful permanent residents. They might be here on valid student visas. They might be specialty occupation professionals. None of them are safe because their status could be revoked at any time, or they could simply be put into a detention process that doesn't even allow them to argue the fact that they're here actually lawfully and are contributing to our society.
Without revealing names or personal information, is there a case that's come to you that you could tell us about that would serve as an example for how this is playing out?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my practice, which is primarily employment-based, a lot of employers are concerned that their very vital employees are able to continue being in the United States, continue working for their company, especially, you know, travel is an issue, which they've not had issues with before, but now we're seeing a lot of people being turned back at ports of entry. So if they've taken a trip and they come back, especially a business trip, they may be in danger of not being allowed into the United States. And again, there's very little due process in that situation as well. Like if you're in an airport and Customs and Border Protection says you can't enter the country, you don't really have a lot of choice but to leave and try to figure this out abroad, which is a huge impact on any company who is reliant on these individuals to do their job in the United States and who have spent considerable resources getting them that lawful status, that visa status. People are also very eager to make sure that their green card applications are filed, that their citizenship applications are filed and at least pending, so that they have some level of protection, which is, or at least assumed protection, because they have this pending application. It is something that is impacting hundreds and hundreds of individuals just in Kentucky, and of course, tens of thousands across the nation.
A right that we have long understood to be guaranteed under the Constitution holds that anyone born in the United States is considered a citizen at birth, regardless of their parents' citizenship or legal status. But after taking office in January, President Trump ordered federal agencies to refuse to recognize the citizenship of children born in the U.S. who don't have at least one parent who is an American citizen or a lawful permanent resident. That order was blocked by three separate U.S. District Court judges, and that sent the case to the Supreme Court. The resulting Supreme Court decision that came in late June said Trump's policy could go into effect in 30 days, but appeared to leave open the possibility of further actions in the lower courts that could keep the policy blocked. So there's a lot of uncertainty around birthright citizenship, which has seemed to be a bedrock right. What are your thoughts about all of that confusion?
To add to some of that confusion, the case that went before the Supreme Court on birthright citizenship, which they said, you know, could not be implemented for 30 days, was really also about how much a judge, a federal judge, could stop some of these policies. So it really curtailed this decision, the ability of federal judges to impose nationwide injunctions on these policies, stopping them, even if it's specifically heard in one circuit, stopping it nationwide. And you saw that with the CHNV parole. You saw it in countless other cases where the judge said this is impacting, correctly so, impacting so many individuals across the country, that we need a nationwide injunction while the case on its merits proceeds through the courts, because the harm is devastating and immediate to these families and these individuals. So what the Supreme Court decided is that they would not have that authority moving forward. So for instance, you're, and specifically in the context of birthright citizenship, if you're born in a jurisdiction, you live in a jurisdiction or a specific circuit that allows birthright citizenship, or maybe a case is still pending in court, you may be considered a citizen, which means that you are issued documents that, like a birth certificate, that would pronounce you to be a citizen, which is also what that executive order stopped. It was basically saying nobody would be issued documents that said that they were lawful citizens of the United States. But if you live in another circuit or in another state, that may mean that you're no longer eligible for birthright citizenship. And so the confusion and the chaos is amplified by the completely disparate ways that any given state or any given circuit might handle this specific issue. So somebody might be considered a citizen in Maryland, but they would not be considered a citizen in Kentucky. So how would a person living in the United States resolve that? You can't ever travel to another state, or you have certain states that you just cannot step foot in. None of that has been thought through or even really discussed in the Supreme Court decision. They just made it about the authority of judges to curtail this administration's policies on a nationwide basis.
The last time we talked, I asked you what you want us to understand, and you said that we need to understand that this is about a lot more than immigration. We've seen people being detained for speaking out against administration policies. That was back in March. Do you have fresh concerns?
Yes, those concerns, I think, have been justified. And we are seeing this increase of individuals, as I mentioned before, who are not criminals, who are here potentially lawfully, you know, just recently we had a court ruling that temporary protected status for Haitians would continue, which it was terminated by the Secretary of Homeland Security. And so the uncertainty of who is legal, who is not legal, and on what basis is seemingly arbitrary at this point, because the administration is not following the laws and statutes and regulations that have been in place. They are changing them without the procedural safeguards that are in place for, you know, notice and comment and making sure that it is abiding by our Constitution. They're taking steps to essentially round up individuals, whether or not they're here lawfully, that they'll just decide that later. Of course, if you deport somebody to a third country where they have no connection and maybe don't speak the language, have no idea whether an attorney is even available to them, it is very difficult at that point, as we've seen in the case of Abrego Garcia, to come back because you're stuck there. And it is something that is so outside the bounds of our Constitution and our laws that it is very, very concerning the ways in which they're ramping up, whether or not it's immigration related, just the rounding up of people and disappearing them into detention facilities or potentially just sending them abroad to various countries that are, you know, potentially getting paid and have that incentive to make sure that they accept these individuals, but that have zero concern about humanitarian conditions or conditions within the facilities. We will have no idea where these individuals are being taken. And that is a hallmark of authoritarian regimes. And it should be very alarming. The premises that these agents are using, for instance, if you are protesting against the treatment of Palestinian people in Gaza, that might be a violation according to this administration because it's impacting foreign policy. Now, that has been stopped by courts as well, that line of reasoning, but that has not stopped the enforcement efforts and the enforcement actions that are taking place on that same reason and logic. And we are in a moment where if we are not able to do something to safeguard our judicial system, that is the only check we have left. We have seen that Congress has essentially abdicated its responsibility to be a check on the executive. And the only thing left are some federal judges, federal court judges that are trying to stop some of these policies while they're determined to be lawful or constitutional. And now that authority has been limited to the specific circuit in which they sit. And so it is something that we should all be very concerned with. If anything, my concerns are amplified and are growing each day as we see new and more creative ways that this administration is just flouting our Constitution and our laws.
I've been talking with State Representative, founder of the New Americans Initiative, and immigration employment attorney Nima Kulkarni. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our request for an interview with an ICE representative was declined. Same response from the offices of Congressmen Hal Rogers and Andy Barr. With me here in the studio is Javier Hernandez, farm manager at Woodstock Farm, a horse boarding stable in Fayette County. We invited Javier to join us on Eastern Standard to talk about his journey and also what he can tell us about how President Trump's deportation sweeps are affecting his employees and farm operations. Welcome, Javier.
Well, thank you very much for having me here and doing this for us. You know, we really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you coming in. I know you're really busy. And let's begin with that. Woodstock Farm, what can you tell us about it?
So Woodstock Farm is a boarding operation owned by the Berger family, Benjamin Berger. I've been working for them for the last 10 years, but I know Benjamin personally for the last 22, 23 years. Obviously, I've been working with horses for a long time, and, you know, he came to the point where he needed a really good person to kind of run his farm and do everything. And he hired me. Actually, his dad hired me to do the job. I started working for his dad. Sadly, he passed away 3 years after I started working for them. And then Benjamin Berger became my boss.
Well, when did you arrive in the United States and then Kentucky?
So I came to the United States on July 1998, as soon as I graduated from college in Mexico. So I grew up with horses in a small ranch, you know, and that was my goal, to come to Kentucky and work with horses. So as soon as I turned 18, I came here and I just started doing my own thing.
And you have legal status.
Yes, correct.
How long did it take to obtain that?
So it took me about 4 or 5 years to become a resident. And then once I got the residency, I just kind of slacked for a little bit. And then I was like, well, you know, I really want to do my my citizenship. So I started studying and I got my citizenship done and I'm a citizen. So, yes.
Did you go through the naturalization ceremony? And
correct. The whole thing, yes.
When you first started out, when you got here, what were you doing? How were you supporting yourself and your family?
So when I came to the States, I started working for TaylorMade Farm. It's a big farm here at Nicholasville Road. So I started with them. And I started, you know, when I got here, I didn't know how to speak English. I didn't know how to drive. I didn't know anything. So my uncle from my mom's side, he brought me to the States and I started working there. It was rough. It was rough. My dad left when I was 10. So I grew up without that. And it was tough because I'm the older out of 6 kids. So it was tough, you know, financially. So the first thing that I told my mom, I said, look, when I go to the States, I'm going to save some money and I'm going to build you a house because we used to rent here and there and it wasn't pretty, you know. So that was the first thing that I did. So I worked at TaylorMade Farm from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., kind of rent sofa day out there, one of the bones over there, and then went to work at McDonald's from like 8 to midnight. But I had a goal and I wanted to do what I had on mind.
And did you accomplish that?
Oh, yes. 3 years. Yes.
That's great. So I'm told that you eventually worked your way up to the position of farm manager at Woodstock Farm.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So when I came to the States and I started working with horses, I saw the horse industry very, very outgrowing, if it makes sense. So I thought, you know, this is easy. As long as you really like what you do and you get the, you know, the guts to do it, and you take the chance and go for it. And that's what I did. So I started learning English. I started, you know, learn how to drive. And then I was like, okay, well, you know, it seems like this is doing good. So I started hanging out with the general managers, so the managers and the veterinarians, farriers and stuff like that. And I started just to learn and to learn, to learn, to learn. Now, that was on my personal time. I didn't get paid for it, you know, but I wanted to learn because I wanted to go the extra mile. So, you know, bit by bit, I became an assistant manager and then a foreman and then another assistant manager and then eventually, and then until here I am.
Here you are. How many employees do you supervise and how many of them are migrant or immigrant workers?
So I have 9 people under me. 3 of those people became with work visas. The other 7 are illegally here. And then, you know, other than that, you know, I kind of run the blacksmiths, the veterinarians, and I do take care of a few clients as well, too.
Just to clarify, you said the others are legally here?
Illegally here.
Okay.
So I got 3 that came with work visa, and then the other guys are illegally here.
So they are susceptible to what's going on right now.
Correct, yes.
What is that like?
So it's kind of tough because when Mr. Trump came aboard, you know, back on January, when everything kind of, you know, started getting a little crazy, we had a little chat and I told him, look, you guys aren't doing anything wrong. You're working, you know, you're making money, you're sending some money, you're providing for your families. Just watch out. I mean, just watch out. Try to do the best that you can and do your daily routine. I mean, don't be scared either, because if you're scared, you know, that's not going to be good. But just try to be yourself, and then you get pulled over, then, you know, I mean, I can help you up, or we can help you up as, you know, as a farm. But if it gets out of our hands, then we can try to figure out.
Do you have any concerns about this interview? ICE might be listening, and they may come.
Oh, no, really, no. No, I don't have no concerns, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what can you tell us about the mood among them, about any anxieties, about possibly being detained?
So, I got one guy, he lives in Paris, Kentucky, and once in a while, you know, he calls me up in the morning, and, you know, it takes him about 45 minutes commute. So he calls me around 6 o'clock, you know, every morning or whenever he calls me, he says, hey, I ain't not going to make it because there are checkpoints over here, so I don't want to take a chance. And I'm like, okay, we understand. So I tell to my boss, and you know, we completely understand. But, you know, if I had a busy day or something major will happen or something major at the farm, then I needed the extra person, then I'd be like, all right, well, you know, what am I going to do?
Are there issues with people not showing up?
Yes, yes. You know, construction people, tobacco people, you know, at the farms, at the track. Did you hear what happened, you know, down in Louisiana just last month? So things like that, you know, because of what happened, a lot of people get scared, and then the world doesn't circulate as it should be.
Is it having an impact on farm operations?
Yes, correct, yes.
In what way?
So in a way where a big farm, and instead of being available to hire illegals here and there, they cannot do that anymore. They had to hire legal persons, or they have to bring, you know, people from anywhere in the world. But it's a big process. Now, they pay really low, so nobody wants to come. Plus, they don't have the experience that some of the guys that they live here already have. So, yes, it definitely affects them in that way.
Well, you know, you've been in the business now for quite a while. Mm-hmm. What would you say about the impact of all this deportation activity on the equine industry in Kentucky?
Some of the farms, they only had like 2 or 3 employees, and they decided to kind of just shut down. They are like, we don't want to do this anymore because we cannot hire any people.
Well, Javier, this is an opportunity to speak to people in central and eastern Kentucky. And I'm wondering what you would like to tell them about becoming a citizen and part of a community.
So be strong in your community. You know, try to be aware of what's going on always. I mean, if you can push it a little bit, you know, try to be aware of what's going on in Kentucky itself. Look after your family. Definitely try to go to work regardless of, you know, what it is. I mean, you know, there's a God somewhere, and he's going to be looking after you as a person or as a group or whatever else. So don't be scared. Just try to do the best that you can, you know, without, you know, worrying about it. But at the same time, if you are a resident, I will strongly suggest to become a citizen. Regardless of the test, the naturalization test, it's not that hard. It's very easy. You just have to kind of just get into it, you know. If you wanted to do it and you're like, you don't really into the English part, they actually have translators who can actually translate for you over there as long as you, you know, you do everything right. And then they make it happen. Now, if you are thinking of, you know, getting a residency or things like that, get it on. Let's get it on. The more that, you know, we are legal here in this country, the more powerful that we're going to become.
Is the current atmosphere making it difficult to obtain residency?
Yes, definitely. Yes. Harder than ever.
What kind of obstacles are being encountered?
So before, there were one of the ways that, you know, if you fall in love with somebody, regardless of where they were from, as long as they were legal, that you can apply and then you got legal. But now without the shutdown, like you cannot do it anymore. If you're a resident, unless you know you have a clean record and everything is perfect, then you might apply and they might accept you. But if you have one or two little things right there, you know, that you got pulled over because you run a light or whatever, they're gonna bring that up and they're gonna be like, no, just maybe hold or if you apply, they're gonna send you back home.
That's Javier Hernandez, farm manager at Woodstock Farm in Fayette County. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Available for viewing at LexArts in downtown Lexington, Hispanics, the Heartbeat of Kentucky's Equine Industry. It's an exhibition of photography, videos, paintings, and poetry by artists including Gloria Arteaga, Carmen Ruiz Diego, Andrea Marroquin, and Georgie Medina Macarno. Gloria Arteaga, by the way, who helped arrange the interview with Javier Hernandez, tells me the exhibit is a celebration of the human connection vital to the horse racing industry that's so important to the bluegrass economy and identity. The exhibition at LexArts runs through August 31st. Coming up after the break, Kevin Nance on his new book of poetry, Smoke, an art farm opens in Lexington.
An independent organization of, by, and for working-class artists and our neighbors.
I'm Tom Martin. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top 5 stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Kevin Nance is a writer, photographer, and arts journalist. He was born in rural North Carolina, grew up there, but has lived for many years right here in Lexington. Kevin's poems have appeared in many literary journals, including Cumberland Poetry Review, which awarded him the Robert Penn Warren Poetry Prize. As an arts journalist, his work has been published in The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, The Chicago Tribune, The Chicago Sun-Times, Poets and Writers Magazine, and other publications. He is co-host, along with Jay McCoy, of Kentucky Writers Roundtable. It's a literary interview program on Radio Lex. And he has been a contributing interviewer for us right here at Eastern Standard, as well as a contributing writer for our partner online arts magazine under mainarts.org. Today, we're switching seats here in the studio to talk with Kevin about his new book of poetry, Smoke, described by the publisher, Lexington's Accents Publishing, as an immersive and evocative, celebratory and heartbreaking journey towards a life of authenticity, personal values, and hard-earned freedom. And it certainly is all of that. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And so let's begin with some context and perspective. Tell us more about growing up in North Carolina.
Well, I grew up in eastern North Carolina on a tobacco farm, a small farm. And the first section of the book tells that story about growing up there, being part of the life of the farm, my relationships with my parents, and other aspects of coming of age in that time and place. We didn't know at the time that we were really in the last generation of small tobacco farmers that did it the way that is described in some of my poems. We were right on the edge of automation in a big way, and all of the work that I describe in some of the poems is now done by large machines. And so it's kind of, you know, North Carolina tobacco farm meets the adding machine in a way.
Well, I've been dying to ask you how a boy from a Carolina tobacco farm goes on to become a Duke University graduate and a fine journalist, writer, and poet. How did that happen?
Well, you know, I got interested in poetry very early on. I discovered Walt Whitman as a teenager in high school. I was so taken with him and other poets. I mean, you know, sometimes I look back on the stuff I was reading, things like, you know, Khalil Gibran, for example, and I wonder, you know, how in the world did I ever find my own true voice, because, you know, I was sort of imitating those people early on. But that's how you learn. You learn by reading and digesting and figuring out what your own voice sounds like and what you want to say. And that's what I did. Then when I went to Duke, I came under the tutelage of a wonderful faculty member and poet there named James Applewhite. I was also a student of Reynolds Price, better known as a novelist, but also a wonderful poet. And they taught me a trick or two, as you say.
Well, this collection of poetry seems to me to serve as something of a memoir, since it covers the span of your life. Is that your intent?
I think so. I think so, especially the first section. There are four sections. The first deals with my early life in North Carolina. The second deals with more or less my poor attempts at having a love life. The third section deals largely with my life as a Kentuckian, being life in Lexington, things that have happened here to me in this wonderful Commonwealth. And then the final section is a sort of series of meditations on aging, mortality, and beyond.
Details of the moments that you've captured can be really vivid, visceral, but you do also spark the imagination. And as an example, in Gathering Tobacco, you transport us to that North Carolina tobacco field in the early morning, and then under the hot sun of a long and exhausting day of grueling work of harvesting, because that's what it is. So I wonder if you could give us a reading of Gathering Tobacco.
Absolutely. And I'll mention that this was my first published poem.
Wow.
It appeared in Poet Lore magazine in 1979. Daddy makes me work right along with the hired hands in the field. He gets big, rough, laughing boys from miles around to do the cropping. They always know I'm the know-it-all dirt farmer's kid, book smart but no common sense, who thinks he's above all this, but still has to work daylight to sundown all summer, just like they do, while his classmates in town sip Pepsi-Cola by the pool. Daddy looks down from his seat on the tractor and gives me a look. Don't pay them no mind. It's chilly in the early mornings, dew like ice water on the tobacco leaves. I dread touching the first leaf, always dripping wet, and have to carry it with a sheaf of others under my arm, which is why I've got on an undershirt and two outer shirts and a jacket, layers I peel off one by one. When I snap the rubbery leaves off the stalk, nasty green tobacco juice squirts out from the stems, and sometimes it catches me in the eye and burns. I'm soaked to the skin with dew and sweat and pesticide residue when the sun comes out and dries me off. Daddy waits till we throw our armfuls of leaves on the trailer, then gives it the gas and creeps up the row. By noon, we're roasting, Daddy and the rough boys and me. On sand-lugging days early in the season, we bend down double for the biggest and lowest leaves where the rattlesnakes nest, and a hot gust of our own stink drifts up from our collars and armpits. Sometimes we go white in the face and throw up bile. Daddy gives it the gas and yells, "Load it or tote it, boys," and I feel small under the sky. When the barn's full, it's almost dark. Daddy pays the rough boys in good hard cash, not a dime left over from me. I stand there covered in black tobacco tar. He says, "Don't know what I'd do without you, son." I don't know either, and smile without showing my teeth, and wish he'd just go on and take the boys home so I can run to the house and scrub myself all over with ivory soap and drink a Pepsi-Cola.
See what I mean, listener? What motivated you to title this book Smoke? I know that there is a poem titled Smoke.
Yes, you know, smoke is a theme, really, in the book. The word keeps coming up throughout the book, both in the section that deals with my life in North Carolina, but also in the subsequent sections. I think the first meaning of it for me is, of course, that my father smoked, and everybody I knew smoked. I didn't smoke, actually. My older brother did, but I never took up the habit, and I thank God for that, because I have two brothers, both of whom are dead of heart disease related to smoking, and my father died at 53 of heart disease related to smoking. And I was very conscious as I was growing up that, you know, my family business, so to speak, was raising a crop that had this poison in it that killed people. And it's right there on the package. The Surgeon General tells you it's not safe. It's bad for you. And so my father was a fourth-generation tobacco farmer. And I think he struggled with that sense of the tradition of it for him, and the pride that he had in growing this crop, and the fact that he knew on some level that we were complicit in this plague that was just scouring the land. His very best friend died of lung cancer, almost certainly related to heavy tobacco use. And I remember that very well. And so The poem that I'm going to read next, which is called Smoke, is a kind of way of conceiving of smoke as both a physical reality and a kind of metaphor for a lot of other things, particularly those relating to passing into the next world.
All right. I've read the poem Smoke, of course. I hear it in my own voice, but I've been looking forward to hearing it in yours.
It gets in your eyes. It rises from the ashes you scatter on your clothes, a mist that lifts from the swamp and climbs the steps to your bedroom in the middle of the night, sits on your chest and steals your breath like a cat. It's neighborly, settling on the porches of your heart and lungs and set in a spell. It issues from your mouth as a skein of silk like a magic trick, a ghost tongue uncoiling like a dancing snake. It sighs like the soul leaving the body at death. It circles your head like a wreath.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Kevin Nance about his new book of poetry, Smoke. That was the title poem from the work. And Kevin, I know that you've received some early and impressive praise for this work, from some of Kentucky's great writers of our times, one of them, Fenton Johnson. He calls it a major literary achievement. And he says Nance's poems are tender, poignant, elegiac, and at the same time as invigorating as any honest engagement with the past, the real past, the authentic past, should be. So I wonder, were there hurdles to overcome as you consider just how open and authentic to be?
Not about the tobacco world or in my early life. I think I was fairly free, felt fairly free. In addition to growing up on a tobacco farm, I was also having a coming of age as a gay person. And that was a different time and a different setting. And to speak of that or be open about it at that time seemed impossible to me, and it was impossible.
And did you know that about yourself when you were working with the quote-unquote rough boys?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. And I was conscious of that, and I suspect they may have been too, of that difference. And that was another part of the barrier between me and them. That barrier is still there today. I still feel it. Even in my everyday life, you know, I'm 65 years old, and I, you know, when people meet me, sometimes if I feel it's relevant, you know, it does come up. It's very rarely relevant, though. But I think you would see if you read the poems closely in the book, there are numerous sort of quiet, I won't say hidden, but quiet references to my sexuality in the poems throughout the book.
I'm sure that among our listeners are some people who have the talent to write, they have the skills, they want to do it, but struggle to get going, to commit. You're looking at one of them. Any words of
wisdom? It happens to people. You know, I have struggled with it. As I mentioned in the book, I wrote a lot of poems from the time I was in high school all the way to my early 40s. And then I sort of ran out of gas. I didn't have the motivation, and I basically stopped writing poetry for about 15 years. I think the biggest reason was that before that point, I'd always had sort of a poetry posse around me. I had people who read poetry, loved poetry, talked about poetry, shared poetry, and gave feedback on poetry. And then what happened is I moved to Chicago, and I went there to work for the Chicago Sun-Times and kind of got very involved in that world. And I didn't have poets around me, and I didn't have people interested in literature around me. And so I sort of dropped it. And it was only when I moved back to Lexington in 2019, that I took up poetry again. And again, I think it was largely because I developed a poetry community. I have several different poetry groups that I am part of, including a group of my very closest friends. No, we call ourselves the Blueberry Group, named after the Bloomsbury Group of English literature lore. We are nothing like Virginia Woolf and Lytton Strachey, but we give ourselves that air. And it really, you know, poetry is not a living. Unless you're Ada Limón or Billy Collins, you don't make a living as a poet. Maybe you make a living teaching poetry, but we can probably count on literally two hands the number of poets who make a good living as just as from selling books of poetry. So there's no money in it per se. You do it for other reasons. You do it because you must, because you want to, because you there's this drive inside you to share something and to shape it. You know, there's a wonderful challenge in having a thought, having a message, and then shaping it into a poem that satisfies you. That is a tremendous thing when it happens. And I am lucky that it's happened to me a few times in my life, and that's what is the contents of this book.
Well, Lexington's a city of 300,000-plus people. Would you say that its proportion of poets and people who are interested in poetry is pretty significant?
I think so. I mean, you know, I know from working on Kentucky Writers Roundtable, which you were kind enough to mention earlier, that there's a lot of people writing poetry in this town. There's a lot of people who publish it. I mean, you know, Katerina Stoykova, who is my publisher at Accents Publishing, she's published, I think, something like over 100 books in her 15 years as a publisher. So she has added a tremendous amount to the culture of this community, as have people like Larry Moore, who's with Broadstone Books out of Frankfurt, and Virginia Underwood, who is a publisher here. Her house is called Shadeland House Modern Press. You know, the University Press of Kentucky also publishes wonderful books. And Silas House has an imprint there that has been publishing wonderful stuff in the last few years. So I think we're blessed here in Kentucky and Central Kentucky in particular, in the number of people who are meeting, talking, writing, and living poetry. And so I count myself very gladly and proudly among their number.
All right, that's Kevin Nance, freelance arts journalist, photographer, and as you've just heard, quite a poet. And by the way, you can find his photography online at kevinnance.tumblr.com. And before you go, how about the book? How can we get our hands on this book?
The book is available for pre-order right now on the Accents Publishing website.
All right, well, thank you so much for this work and for joining us, Kevin.
Thank you.
Max Pacholski is a co-founder of Art Farm. It's a new common space for art making and organizing on Winchester Road. It occupies a former pawn shop on Winchester. Max is here to tell us all about it. Thanks for joining us, Max.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So what is Art Farm?
Art Farm is a commons for art and organizing toward a more free, caring, and ecological world. We sort of combine the creative autonomy of an artist-run space with the democratic spirit of a free school. And by doing this, we hope to fill a critical gap in Lexington's aesthetic ecology, an independent organization of, by, and for working-class artists and our neighbors.
Tell us a little bit about what we would find when we walk through the door at Art Farm.
As you mentioned, we took over a 5,000-square-foot, single-story cinder block building, and we've built out partitions for artist studios, for organizational offices. Our main commons area functions as a creative co-working space by day and an event space by night. So we've converted our garage into a gallery space. We have the Lexington Tool Library, which is a benefit for members. And we also have something called a really, really free store, which is Lexington's only store where nothing is for sale and everything is free.
Tell us about that tool library. That sounds interesting.
That's right. So the tool library was a pre-existing organization and was at the end of its term at a previous space and was looking for new space. And it kind of dovetailed very nicely with our search for space for this art farm project. And it worked out such that the tool library was able to relocate to Art Farm. And we have a whole range of tools, hand tools, power tools, kitchen tools, garden tools, some sports equipment, camping gear, very expansive definition of tools, in other words. And we also are the home of the Lexington Tool Mobile. So we have a 16-foot box truck that we have converted. I think it triples or quadruples our storage of tools.
Wow.
And have some aspirations to, the tool library does, I should say, to post up at different sites around town, parks, and make that collection available for the people of Lexington.
Somebody out there is going through an estate situation and they've got tools to contribute. Is that welcome?
Yes. We have a wish list published on our website of things that we're most looking for. I think it's lextools.org. Art Farm also has a wish list, I should add, artfarm.coop/wishlist. So
I need a tool. I can come in and check it out?
Yes, that's right. So you sign up as a member. Standard membership is $25 a month with Art Farm, but it's sliding scale, so anything greater or less is appreciated. And we don't turn anybody away for lack of funds. And it can fluctuate from month to month. So if some months it needs to be $0 or $1, that's perfectly fine. And you can come in and sign up and check out any tool that you need. All rentals are for a 1 week period, and you can renew for an additional week if you need it.
I saw on your site that you have monthly financial transparency meetings and quarterly commons maintenance meetings, and it looks like it's a very open operation that everybody can kind of understand what's going on. Tell us a little bit more about that.
That's right. So Art Farm evolves iteratively, like a work of art, through experimentation and revision. So this means that many decisions are yet to be made. And so we are relying on member participation because we know that democracy makes better decisions. So shared governance among members, as you say, will promote transparency and accountability. We can practice making decisions together, practice assembling, practice resource sharing between and among the different organizations, the individual members of Art Farm, and the general public. And monthly financial transparency meetings are one important way that we do that.
That's Max Pachalski, co-founder of Art Farm, new common space for art making and organizing on Winchester Road in Lexington. Thank you so much for coming in, Max.
Thanks very much, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.